Word. Well, hello, Mr. Hayward.
Hi.
We are meeting to talk about whatever we want to talk about. So, my name is Jamie Spires, and as you already know, I'm very interested in plants and, you know, the different clan art, the Frog Clan and other things, and all your fishing and salmon smoking experience. So, I guess we could start out with, I remember the other day you were talking about Devil's Club and how you had remembered some type of use for that, and I was interested in learning more.
Yeah, what I remember my grandparents using it for was when they get colds, you know, you use menthol item.
Yeah.
Well, they take this devil club and they cut the bark off. I mean, you know, the outside, and they put it in water and boil it, and they take a cloth or some towels,
smell.
And breathe that. Breathe that. It clears up. As I remember, it clears your nose. And it's kind of almost a bitter, very bitter when you taste it. I remember tasting it. And even the smell is kind of, you know, strong. So
it's very distinct.
Yeah. That's what I remember about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it grows out in the wild. You know, I don't know if I described it, the plant. What I remember is it used to grow about 3 or 4 feet tall. And the leaves get pretty big, you know, they're maybe up to a foot in diameter. They look like a big oak leaf. But underneath the leaf itself are all these thorny. Thorns are about maybe a quarter to a half inch long, and the same way on the bark. The whole thing is covered with these thorns. And if you get stuck with one of them, it could develop an infection. So you got to be real careful in the way you handle it.
That's probably a lot of why it's called Devil's Club, huh?
Yeah.
I know we have them in Talkeetna, but I don't see any here in the interior so much.
Right.
But I bet you have a lot in Southeast being so humid and.
Right.
I bet
there were other plants too that I don't know that they'd have any. Medicinal purposes, but we used to eat it a lot, and that's that wild celery. And it looked like celery, very much like celery, only that it's completely round, and you know, the celery is kind of C-shaped, and this wild celery is round, and it grows pretty fast. I remember. And we used to peel it off and eat it and dip it in sugar, you know.
Oh.
As kids used to do that. And they used to tell, I remember hearing stories that it served some medicinal type of, I forgot what it was. It was pretty small at the time. And they mentioned it. And I just don't recall what it was.
Yeah. Well, I bet just through eating it somehow it might have been good for you.
Yeah.
Ooh, it is strong.
I'm making hot water.
Oh no, it's good. Do you remember any other plants that you would eat, or do you remember anything for medicine? Anything else?
Not to my recollection. The other, I think I told you about once, but that's. Ulligan grease. It has did have some quite bad experience with it myself as a little boy. I developed an infection on my knees. Did I talk about that in your class?
A little bit you did, and I forgot to write that down.
Uh-huh. And I developed an infection on my knee, and the infection went pretty deep to where it strained the fluid out of my knee, so that my knee locked up in a fetal position. At night I slept, and I couldn't straighten them out after, you know, been this way for, it seemed like months, a couple of months, and I was seeing a nurse and a doctor, you know, during that time, and they just didn't seem like they could help me. And my grandmother took charge, I guess you'd say. She put us in she put me in a big tub, a galvanized tub. We used to take baths and as kids, and we need, she put water in as hot as we could stand, and she put Lysol in there, and kill the infection, and I'd kneel in that for, you know, before bedtime for maybe half hour, 45 minutes, and then she took that gauze and, you know, cleaned it up a little bit and cleaned that infection out as best she could, and she wrapped gauze around my leg and tied a board behind my leg as well, saturated that gauze with this hooligan grease.
Oh.
And she wrapped that, you know, with gauze. And that's how I went to bed, with this hooligan grease and that board on my leg.
To keep your leg straight.
Yeah, so they wouldn't.
How smart.
And it didn't take very long. Mm. I would say within a week or 2 weeks, I started getting healing process. Very noticeable, and then at the start of it was very noticeable in a short period of time, and recovered completely from that, because there was a point in there that they thought I wouldn't be able to walk again and regain full use of my leg.
That is so awesome. And she had all that knowledge.
Yeah.
And see, that's not even plants, but I'm interested in that too.
Yeah.
Any type of healing or ways to help people, I think, is so important to remember. I'm really glad that you talked about that.
We eat that. I take, even now, I've got a lot of grease in the house, and I take about a tablespoon almost every day.
Mm.
Like we used to do a long time ago, we used to take cod liver oil.
Yeah, okay.
When we were in grade school, they used to make us take it. It was awful taste of stuff. I guess it was good for you.
Yeah. I bet it's, you know, not the same exactly, but kind of how a lot of people use vitamin E oil. And
It's probably closely related, I would think.
Because
I've run across a lot of different things in alternate medicine. I mentioned it to a previous student.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing more and more that, you know, that kind of medicine was pushed in the background by the now dominant pharmaceutical industry. And they, you know, they would make a lot of negative comments or advertisements about these kind of medicines just to promote their own pharmaceuticals, you know.
Yeah.
And I ran across a doctor, more by accident than anything, but I got a copy of one of his, what they call medical alerts. And he studied alternate medicine to you know, to a high degree. He was trained under the, just like any doctor in modern medicine is trained today. And but when he got out in the field, you know, after many years in the field, he started, you know, hearing about these alternate medicines. You know,
yeah.
Some of them that go back thousands and thousands of years, you know, and he got curious about it and started studying it, and especially the Asian countries.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, there's herbal stuff, you know, plants, and a lot of that, there's a lot of those kind of herbal stuff that do the same things that a lot of, most of the pharmaceutical stuff, but do it in a better,
yeah,
and then
without really side effects.
Yeah, serious side effects. Yeah, that's one advantage that the alternative medicine has over the pharmaceuticals, I think.
Yeah.
But they don't say anything about that.
Of course not.
As I told you. Told previous students that I heard, I mean, this doctor reported, I subscribe to his website now, and he's putting out these alerts, and he's always coming up. He's, like I say, he's put in a lot of years of study, and he developed a lot, utilizing all these herbal stuff and natural stuff, you know, and using for his patients whenever he can, you know.
Yeah.
To try to get away from the, get his patients away from the pharmaceutical stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like we think we have to go buy our medicine because that's all we know anymore.
Well, then he promotes that, you know, you should be responsible for your own health, your own well-being. So don't say, you know, a lot of people say doctors are always right.
Mm.
That's the brainwashing we've gone through all our lives, you know, thinking that. Well, that's not true.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of good things in the pharmaceutical industry, and, you know, a lot of good developments, but, you know, it's becoming money-driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a market that they would lie about, you know, to promote their product. You know, maybe in a gray sense of the word, you know, just, it doesn't take much to convince somebody, you know, to say, yeah, this has some healing properties, when in truth it doesn't. Or if it does, it's very little, you know.
Not like they say
how
high it would work.
I always watch those advertisements on TV, you know, a lot of these aspirins and, you know, a lot of these medicines, they say it's good for you, and then they say, now they're required to say, you can't, you got to list all the, you got to list all the side effects too, and blurt it out real fast and try to.
I know.
You
have exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Or if you're ever going to be pregnant. I mean. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's so silly.
Mm-hmm.
You think, well, then why would I want to take that?
Because it causes those side effects.
Gosh. Well, how about, I know that, you know, this is not necessarily your topic of, you know, highest knowledge, but do you remember your grandmother helping any other sick people or anybody else being sick in your community that there was anything natural or traditional medicine that helped them?
That's No, I was pretty young when that happened. I was,
I would
say I was maybe 5 or 6 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, and I remember it. And but that double club thing was the only really know, the plant life stuff. I know there are more. There are more.
Yeah. I'm on a search.
Yeah.
Find as much as I can, so hopefully someday.
There's a lot of information on the internet. That's where I got a lot of it. I had a heart surgery in 97, I think it was. Had an aortic valve replaced. That was a big plus for me. And it was shortly after that I started checking into these herbs and natural medicine. And I've just to prove it, a lot of these things, you know, there's a lot of, even in that those markets now, there's a lot of misrepresentation of a lot of stuff in there. There's a lot of people in there just to get in the ball game, trying to promote something that really doesn't do anything, and under the guise of natural, you know, and herbs and stuff like that. And you're going to, you know, I would say just a small percentage of them are legitimate. You know, and you just have to pick and choose and test and things like that yourself, you know. And this is what I've done. Over a long period of time, you know, I bought a lot of stuff I knew, you know, I couldn't prove it was right or wrong, or good or bad, until I tried it myself. And this is how it come about, was several things now that I take, by trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because a lot of them are putting on the market now, when they say they'll, if it doesn't work, you can ship it back, and I'll go for those. You know,
yeah.
So you get your money back. But again, even though there's some people that would give you that kind of a guarantee, you know, that there's some of them that are just there to take your money.
Well, why don't we move on to fishing?
Okay.
We talked last time about your dad and the boat and how much he worked on the boat. And since my dad's a fisherman and I never really get to learn from him because his history girls shouldn't know that sort of thing, I'm interested in... Do women get to fish in your culture?
Yeah, now they do. I guess generations before me, you know, there wasn't that many during my generation, but that's, after I got out of it, which was in my mid-20s, I've had several sisters that have gone on in my family, three of them. And there's more of that, and I even, you know, when I was fishing up Whistle Bay, herring fishing, I saw a crew of nothing but women.
Oh, wow.
And a captain on down. They drew a lot of attention, I'll tell you.
I bet they did. Were they successful? Were they good?
Yeah, I mean, she ran a, the captain ran a, you know, really a nice boat, and to get that kind of a boat, you know, it just reflects your skill level, you know, because you're gonna upgrade as you do well in the fishing industry. And she had top of the line gear, and you know, and they were right in there bumping heads with all of us, because we were, I mean, that's a fierce industry,
yeah,
the herring industry. And they didn't back down for nothing. They just took their lumps and gave them too.
Yeah, great. Were there people who didn't like it that they were fishing?
Oh, I'm sure there were. You know, there's the guy thing. You know,
yeah.
There's the. But. They proved themselves, you know. Yeah, there was nothing.
That's good. What's your favorite type of fishing? What kind of things do you like to do the best?
I grew up in purse seining. That's entirely, other than sport fishing, that's the entirely fisheries that I was involved in. You know, we did halibut on the side, you know, off the same boats in the off season, but other than that, we were primarily salmon fishing, purse seiners.
And so you would consider that maybe like where your heart lies in the fishing, or?
Yeah, that's where I developed my love for the fishing industry. Because my dad was in that, you know, primary. We had other fisheries, you know, but they were on a, like I say, on the side. Mm-hmm. It was just in the off season when the salmon weren't going out, halibut fishing, cod fishing, you know, long lining.
Mm-hmm.
Usually long lining. Now they have, since I got out, they've added diving for cucumbers, sea cucumbers, and there's another. It's funny look. It looked like a ball with spines on it.
Sea urchin.
Sea urchins, right? Right. That's a big. That's starting to develop into a big fisheries down there, and they dive for that.
Would you ever want to do that? Sounds dangerous.
You know, it's a young man, that kind of a game is a young man's game, because it requires a lot of body strength, swimming, you know. And,
yeah.
I suppose I could do it, but I'm you know, looking at it. since I've never done it, I heard that it's dangerous,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of things happen to especially in the early days, when the inexperience was prevalent, you know. Those people have got the bends. I don't know if you heard about.
I've heard of
it. Yeah, they came up too fast. A lot of times they came up too fast, not because they wanted to, because the tide pulled them up. You see, they're attached to a tether line down to the bottom, and when they're in deep water, they have to come up in stages,
mm-hmm.
you know, to so that bends won't. You know, it won't build up in your body, and that's what you have, to do it. But when the tide runs and the boat's anchored, it'll pull you up. The tide pull you right up to the surface. It's like a swing, you know.
Wow.
Like that. And that's happened. The guy tried to swim back down, you know, and he can't do it.
So he didn't even have a chance.
No, it's you have to be well aware of all these. Situations that you try to avoid to put you in a bad situation.
Yeah. Wow. Sounds fun but scary too, huh?
Mm-hmm. They're set up so that they have a tether cable, and on that tether cable is the airline, you know, attached to your headgear. And also communications lines so they can talk directly with the diver on the boat.
Mm.
And they have to go through training, you know, they have to know all about all the risks involved. A lot of them are sent outside to train for that. But that situation where, you know, that when you can't control coming up because the tide just pulls you in, the tide that goes and pop right up in the port.
Yeah. Do you know how they how do they prepare the sea cucumber and sea urchin? Do you?
You know, I don't know. This is an industry that came along after I got off. It's I don't know how it's done.
Because I've not heard of it.
Yeah. I even like herring. I got into it after there was very, very few people involved in the herring industry when I quit the salmon industry. And now herring's big. Mm. It's all the way, you know, it's all up and down the entire coast of America. I mean, you can go all the way. Like, our fisheries in the United States starts down in California, mm. San Francisco Bay, and moves up as a, you know, this water temperature rises, mm-hmm. and they just move along from area to area, San Francisco and Washington and then Canada and then southeast and then all the way, and then all the way out to the Aleutian Chain and Bristol Bay and then Norton Sound, and just right up the line.
So does that mean that you would start down in the California area?
That could, you could do that, but none of them, there's very few that fish that way. Mm. We, since we're from Alaska, we'll hit the Alaskan seasons as they move up.
Okay.
And one that I fish predominantly was in Bristol Bay, mm-hmm. called Togiak herring fisheries. That's around above Dillingham and
King Salmon.
Yeah.
I've heard that it's really dangerous in
it
that
is.
Area.
It is. Where I fished, and I had a very small boat that was, you know, it was actually a 32-foot gill netter that I converted to a purse seiner. I had a real light net in there. So all my fishing was done in the shallows, right up on the sandbars and things like that. And the reason I did it that way, because all the fish, when they come in, they go into the shallows. You know, I figured if I had a shallow draft boat, it'd be easier for me to get in there than with a deep draft boat, you know, like a 40-footer or 50 or 60-footer. So those guys with the big boats like that had to fish out in the deep, where I could get right up, you know, anywhere my boat can run. And the boats I had, was they only drew about 3 feet of water. And so I could get in, you know, 4 feet of water and make a set. So my idea was that kind of eliminated a lot of the fleet out of my fishing grounds, you know, like the bigger boats and the deeper draft boats. So that allowed me to fish, you know, almost without interference from the other boats. So that's the way I looked at it. Because a lot of the herring, they spawn in all these shallow waters like that.
It seems like the smart way to do it. You know, if everybody else is going to be out there, mm-hmm. you follow the fish up and don't have as much competition.
Mm-hmm. I did that for about 10 years. What I did was I took a basic gill netter and then converted it into a purse seiner. And I said, I ran a boat for a guy there, and I told him I went with him. The first time I went out there, I ran a boat that he had rigged up, and it was just a, to me, in my way of thinking, the way we purse seine just didn't make any sense, you know, the way he had a setup. And I told him the next year, I said, if I go fishing with you again, I'm going to rig that boat the way I want it, you know. And I spent the entire winter talking to him about it and told him what I thought about his rig, this posted type I'm used to, you know. Because I was going to set it up the way we have it set up in Southeast. And he fought it for a while, but then they convinced him, said, well, I'm not going to run that boat like you had it. I said, I'll work for somebody else. And he finally, and I said, I got to have this, know whether you're going to do this by March, because that's about when the time I need to work on it, you know, get the boat configured right and put up the rigging right and all that stuff I need, all the hardware, the nets and everything put together. Well, it's going to need at least 3 months to do this. And so, and when he finally agreed to it, it was about February, I guess. And that's when I started putting all the stuff, getting all the stuff together. I built my own skiff and all that, and aluminum. And the rigging I made out of aluminum. And I flew it all down there prior to the season. And I put it up. It did real good that trip. You know, we put in 150 metric ton in the one set. And the following year I had another 150 ton set. 3 years in a row. But then it fell apart after that. I kept at it for 10 years. Couldn't make a go of it after that. Got out.
With herring, how do you prepare it, or do you?
We don't.
We don't.
We don't touch fish one when we catch them.
Oh.
The Japanese do all that. We sell it to them.
Yeah. They're number one, right? Number one.
Yeah, we just sell it to the. The Japanese bring over a big fleet of trawlers, big 300-400 foot long trawlers, and they're actually processing plants, floating processing plants, and they freeze it. We sell it, and they would check it themselves. You know, they'd send aboard technicians, and when we make a set, they'll sample our fish. Pick a dip net and grab a few of the herring and break them open. Mm-hmm. See how much eggs there are in them. Then they'll weigh the eggs and the carcasses separately, come up with a percentage of body weight versus the eggs. And when they set a limit like, 8% egg content will buy the fish or higher. 8% or higher, and then and they'll pay you on that basis.
So mostly they're just wanting the eggs.
Yeah, that's all.
Yeah.
Huh. But we sell them the whole thing, and they take it on these trawlers and freeze them up right on the trawlers, take them back to Japan, and process them over there. So we never see the actual process. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it was all the time over there. But they did always have all these technicians that were on the packers that pumped the fish out of your net. That's why I say we never touch the fish. We just mix the set, bag it up, and make it tight and so they can stick to it.
You know, just suck them out, right?
Yeah, big 14-inch hoses, you know. They suck them directly out of the net into the tender. And then the tenders would take them over the, and they would take a sample every 10 tons of fish that come out of the net. And then they'll take an average of that. And that's what they'll pay you. Mm.
Gosh, it's hard to imagine how much, like, just 10 tons would be. It's so much.
Because you've been around boats, huh? You know those big flat scows? You know, like... they're just big scows with a cabin on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we call them flat scows. I filled three of those up one time in one set.
That's so much fish. Do you get excited?
They're about 50 tons a piece.
Wow. Yeah, maybe someday I'll get to.
It took that many days to pump it out.
Oh. As far as salmon, though, it doesn't work like that. You don't just suck them up like that, right?
No, you have to dip them out with a straight big hook. Okay. 4 feet in diameter. And that's, the closable bottom. Mm.
Cinch it?
Yeah, cinch it shut. You dip them out. The old way was used on that one. Then nowadays they use what they call a sock. It's built right into their net. Into the bunt end of the net. The last part of the net that comes aboard. They sew a sock right into that. So when they pull the net up, as it's pulled in, all that fish will pour into the sock. And they cinch it up and lift it aboard and dump it right into the hatch. They can get the fish aboard a lot quicker that way than the old. And then with less manpower and equipment. So it was a more efficient way. Hmm. Back when I was first sailing, we had to have at least 8 guys aboard the boat. Hmm. Up to 10 guys. Now we can get along with 5 and do the same amount of work. Because that what brought that on was that power block.
And that.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. That took half the. It did all the work. We didn't need to. We used to do a lot of back weight picking work. And the old turntable method. We used to have it. I don't know if you knew about that, but we used to put a turntable on the back end of the boat that you put your net on. And it's like
was
a lazy
it?
Susan.
No.
Yeah, okay, that came out. See, that's the way we used to fish a long time. With that kind of a setup, you had to have 8 to 10 guys aboard to pull that net in. And it was just over a roller.
Mm-hmm.
And that stood on the back end of that cable. It's like a lazy Susan, rotated around like that.
Huh.
We put it back and let that net out, then. And we haul it in, pulling it in on the side, and just rotate that thing around like that, and let the roller stay. We used to haul over a dead roller for a while, and then later on they put power on that roller.
Mm.
And that was a help, but still it was still back-breaking work. And we used to have, my dad's boat, we had electric drive motor. The roller that's on one side of the turntable. Then when we get ready for the next set, we rotate that table around, put the roll on the back so the net when it goes out will go over the top of the roll.
It's a lot of work.
That thing was dangerous, especially when you were working out in the open ocean. We called it the West Coast. You fished out on the swells. On its own, trying to swing around, there's a lot of guys been hurt over the years, killed, just when the tail swinging around with all that, weight of the net on there. So we had to tie that down every time you got it to a position you wanted, you pulled an end in on it, lash it down.
Safety, right, to tie it.
So when the power block came up, that was a big boon to the industry.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about smoking fish?
Okay. You look at smoking fish from all different, even down the different villages down there. Yeah, each one will do it, like the Haidas will do it one way, and the Simpsons did it one way, and then the think as we do another way. They're not all the same. Mm-hmm. And even up here, you look at the Athabasca, they got their way, and the Eskimos have their way. But they all, in one way or another, sometimes are influenced by each other. Like the Athabascans and the Eskimos, a lot of them do it similarly, because they're in proximity to the same area. Over the centuries, I guess, they trade back and forth, or they see each other's work, they end up helping each other or doing it the same way. It is that way down southeast too, but then you look at the way my grandparents did it and they compare it with Athabascans up here, it's just different as night and day. The strips, we don't make strips down back home like you do up here.
No.
But we make what they call Iwaksh, and that's we used to have these little A-frame butchering aids, I guess you call it. We cut the fish almost in half down to the skin. And right through the rib cage down to the skin. Then each side we fold out twice. So by the time it's all laid out, it's probably wider than it is long, the fish. And you've got a big layer of meat on the what's in the middle, the skin. And you put this, drape this over this top, this A-frame. It's about 2 foot long and maybe it stands about 2 feet on each side. And then you flay off these strips, thin strips of just meat off the, and then flay it off later at a time until you have maybe a half inch of meat left on the skin. You do this all the way and it's all even. You take those strips and dry them separate. And you dry this other part, how it sticks upside down. It's just only half to quarter inch of meat on it. That's the way we do our one with the skin on it.
Mm.
It's all one piece. The ribs and everything are still all attached. And we take the tail, we leave about 3 or 4 inches of tail from the edge of the end of the tail, I mean not the end, but it's the narrowest.
Mm.
We leave about 3 inches on there. We leave the skin and everything, and the meat and everything, and then we cut around the backbone like that, all the way around, and what you'll have is, again, another strip of meat on the skin.
Mm-hmm.
Put a hole on that meat part and dry it off and leave it like that. Leave the tail and everything like that. A lot of people like the tail. And the bone is left in there too.
Mm-hmm.
We eat the head. We don't dry it. I guess other people do. Some people dry it, but we never did back home. We like to boil it or bake it. I love fish heads myself. But the main difference is that I walk between the that strips they have up here. And that meat that's kind of like it's chopped, the split fish, all the meat that's attached. And they don't fillet that meat off in layers like we do, but leave it attached to the skin and just cut it at an angle like that, maybe inch or maybe less than that intervals, and then it'll fillet open or flap open when you hang it over that drying stick. See, that's one of them.
Getting spoiled. So this is how
they do it.
Just talking.
Yeah, the Athabascans do it that way. And That's my skin too.
Thank you.
They're very rough. I don't know where they got it from.
Yeah. Mm. Darlene brought this in.
Darlene, is this yours?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
I thought it was part of the residential.
No.
I'm sorry. Which culture is that?
This is probably the Athabascan way.
Athabascan?
Yeah.
And you said you take the skin off?
Yeah. We fillet the meat off. You know, usually about that thick when you just split it open down the middle, mm-hmm. you know, right alongside the backbone on each side. And we leave the backbone. We put right close to one side of the backbone, right down to the skin. You lay it open like that. Then you take the ribs and you cut a line along the rib, and you fold that open down to the right to
oh
the belly.
Oh my gosh! Okay.
And then you do
okay.
the same on the other side.
Oh, and you got a whole.
Right. Yeah. You end
whole,
up with a
yeah.
with it all folded open like that. It'd be about that wide.
Whoa, okay.
Okay, you drape the middle of the back of the fish right over this A-frame and play off this meat, it's probably that much.
Wow.
Play it off until there's only a half inch left on the meat. Same way on the other side of the A-frame. Play that up. You got all these.
Take it off from the
yeah,
skin.
You got.
Take it off from the skin.
No.
Oh.
You just go down to within a half inch of the skin.
Oh.
And you end up with pieces like this, but maybe wider.
Wider.
Yeah, you know that. Maybe
and they're still attached to the skin.
No. It just comes off and fillets. You know, you know how you got about that much meat on each side on the skin when you first split it open.
Mm-hmm.
We'll fillet that down layer at a time, till there's only a half inch left of the meat on the fish, and take those layers and dry them. Separately, so that's all
wow.
we're trying is just the meat itself and the
wow.
strips, and it'll look like that.
It's different.
Yeah.
Totally different, because
yeah.
I'm used
to this.
Yeah.
I haven't heard it that way before.
Yeah, that's the way we do it back home.
Wow.
So it's kind of cool for you guys to learn different new things about the cultures too.
I've never heard it that way before. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So you're from, originally from where?
Metlakatla.
Metlakatla?
You know, I used to like to watch my grandmother. You know, get this already like that.
Wow.
And the thing that I remember most about it was the way it sounded when they cut through that bone, you know, the rib bone that had that juice up. Yeah. Yeah.
That sound, I know that sound.
Sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh no, thank you very much.
I like the residential thing.
I get spoiled.
Over there.
Filleting a fish. You know, that's something I should know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad would never teach me that either. Until this year, he let me watch him. So I was real quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to make him mad, but I watched him do it over and over again. And when I finally got to do one to smoke about a month ago, I did so much better. I still don't have it yet, but I would like to know, like, what's the way you like to cut your fish up, the fastest?
I like the way they do it here. It's probably easier. But I grew up with that method, and I like to fish that way
mm-hmm.
when we eat it. Because we take that, you know, that fish, the meat that's still on the skin,
mm-hmm.
and we'll bake it or put it on an open fire
oh.
with the skin down. And let that skin get like bacon rind, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
that you can find. Mm-hmm. Get that, because the skin can get edible when it's baked like that.
Yeah.
My mouth is getting watery.
Yeah, it's still
I
on,
know.
we take this like when you eat the meat out like this and throw it on a fire, and it curl up like bacon rind.
Yeah.
And then it's real easy to eat after that.
Wow. Okay.
And it's not hard and, you know, chewy.
Yeah.
It just like a... like this.
Kind of crisp, mm-hmm. Right?
Wow.
That sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That sounds wonderful.
Making my mouth watery. Thinking about that, oh my gosh, that sounds delicious.
I swear, mm-hmm. I've had fish every day after I go... come from this class because we mm-hmm. talk about fish, and I get so hungry during class that I go home and I just have to eat some fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah, it's really good for your body.
Mm-hmm.
People who fish a lot, they're so healthy.
Yeah.
You know, the Bethel area people, fish eating people.
Yeah.
You look at the Japanese, you know, for instance, that, you know, their average lifespan is 10 or 15 years
mm-hmm.
above the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they and their activity level carries on in those years. You know, normally we kind of give up or we're so sick or
slow.
You slow down a bit. Not them.
Yeah.
And even further than that, you take those people in the Asian countries way up in the Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
The Himalayas.
Mm-hmm.
And they live over 100 years old, and yeah. they're climbing mountains and stuff like that, you know, that age.
Yeah.
And you have to look at what they eat, see what that, you know, because that's, again, that's where I look at the, I look at alternate medicine, alternate foods and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and a lot of this promotes that kind of, you know, eventual long life and all that. It's something I found out too that, you know, as you get older and you get your health gets worse and worse here in America, it does it over a long period of time and very slowly.
Mm.
And so you don't really notice it, or you don't really care, and you just think, oh, I'm just getting old, I can't do these things anymore. But I corrected a lot of those problems when I turned 60 years old, because I was at that point where arthritis was bad in me, my hands, my wrists, my ankles, and even my back. So I chose to pursue this natural medicine and foods, and I followed that for a long time, for a whole year now. And I take these pills that have all these kind of, you know, use a lot of these Asian type and even, you know, herbs and stuff like that that Asian people use. And reverse a lot of these conditions. I used to get migraine headaches real bad, say 5 years ago. You know, the change of the weather in the springtime, you know, from winter to spring and then to summer,
mm-hmm.
and you know, up here it gets a little damp in that air, and I can tell my body, my vision gets bad. I get to see these sparkly things in, you know, my vision. I haven't had that now for about 3 years.
Wow.
But it took that long to reverse that, those kind of problems. But as long as I kept on it, it got better and better and better. And I completely backed out of those bad conditions. And I got to the point where I can run marathons now. Where, you know, I thought 10 years ago that when I was having all those problems, it was never going to happen. I thought I was never going to hunt again. I've been hunting right up to last year.
No. Name those medicines.
Yeah.
I can't name them because they're, you know, they're names of plants.
Really long.
That, you know, these scientific names for
botanical
them.
Botanical names. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're from Japanese people?
A lot of them. The Asian, all the different Asian countries are big contributors. But people down in South America, people in Europe, you know, all over.
So where do you buy your medicine?
I subscribe to this Al series called the Vitamax. I subscribe to his, because he's a trained modern medicine doctor that saw something different, and then later he weighed the pros and cons about these two different and found out that there's better stuff in this natural herbal stuff than there is in the pharmaceutical industry. See, we're being brainwashed into thinking that this the pharmaceutical industry is better. Mm-hmm. The truth is, there's up to 100,000 people die from pharmaceuticals every year.
They don't advertise that much, do they? Wow.
This guy's name is S-E-A-R-S?
Yeah, like Sears Roebuck.
L. Sears.
L. Sears.
He promotes vitamins.
Yeah, vitamins. Okay. He's one of these scientists that puts together these packages. Like right now, see, I used to have trouble, real bad trouble with my prostate. And I took this one thing that he made just for that. And my prostate, when it got bad, it started swelling up and caused me real bad urinary problems, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in about 6 months, that corrected. And I stayed on a daily test, you know, I took one a day,
mm-hmm.
one of these things. And I used to have to go to the bathroom maybe 4 or 5 times a night, and now I don't. I'm just normal.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, things
that's
like that.
That's great.
So I'm staying on that. I'm in the maintenance type part of the program now. You got to take more during the time you got to back out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Because you know it takes a lot of years for you to get into these bad conditions. You know, and so it's going to take some time to back out and correct it, and then
like prevent anything else from happening.
Yeah, then go into a maintenance mode, preventive. I look at a lot of guys now. See, I'm 60. I'll be 69 here next month, or month and a half now. And like I said, I'm hunting now, and I just carried this moose. Carried 4 quarters out of that, that moose out myself, carried it out myself. And 5 years ago, I didn't even pack 1 quarter before a younger guy had to pick it up for me.
What was the problem? Your knees?
Everything. I had a lot of problems. I had shoulder problems, shortness of breath, you know. Didn't have the stamina, because what this does is build up your stamina again. It's just an overall, you actually end up repairing your body is what you're doing. And like I had arthritic problems, I don't have anymore. My hands were getting bad about 6-7 years ago. That's all crooked.
Wow.
My ankles were swelling up, you know, things like that. I couldn't walk. I mean, I did have a heart operation that did a lot of good too. But this is what put me on this search.
Mm.
Was that correction in my heart? Because if I didn't do that operation, I wouldn't be here today. That was a big factor there. But then. The correction of all the other things that went wrong with my body, you know, I attribute to the things that I've been taking for it.
So many years.
Pardon?
For so many years.
Yeah, it's been about 2 to 3 years I've been taking it. That's the, you know, we've been put in a situation because of the economic situation where we expect things to happen right now.
Yeah.
Instant gratification type thing.
Yeah.
And we expect that to happen. So when you first take a pill, on the yeah. case.
Yes, be cured.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's not true. You gotta correct the problem, and you gotta go enter time. And that correction of the problem takes a long time. And then you get into maintenance level. See, the food chain that we're in now in the United States is very deficient in a lot of the nutritional value that we should be getting. And that alone has contributed to a lot of the problems that we have today.
For instance?
A lot of the vitamins. Okay, a lot of the iron and we have, there's food that we eat that has to say you got iron in it, but yet you got to eat 20 pounds, 30 pounds you have to get the correct amount.
Yeah.
You know, for example. So this is what these pills that I'm taking make up for a lot of those losses.
Yeah.
I know, like, with some vitamins you have to take in conjunction with others for it to go into your body. Mm-hmm. So if you don't take, say, calcium and vitamin C together, you don't get the benefits. So that must be a lot of what those pills do.
It goes right straight through.
Yeah, it'll just go right out and it'll never go into your body. You might think that you're doing good. Oh, I'm going to have this much vitamin C, but it won't.
Maybe
it
only
won't
take
stick.
A fraction of that amount is used by your body. Mm-hmm. The rest goes down the toilet.
Yeah.
And this is what Dr. Sears, he knows that, and he combines some of those nutrients that work and aid each other. And then you'll combine, like, there's another one called CQ10 that everybody should have, that very deficient in our diet, and it contributes to the fact that we're tired, we're lacking energy, we have to sleep 12 hours, I only sleep about 5 hours at the most. And I get up and I feel good all day, and I don't have to go to bed till 10 o'clock at night, 12 o'clock at night, and get up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. This has been my regime now. So there's a lot of, effect that it has on your, positive effect that it has on your body, and in your mind. I had a bad, I don't know.